Side 5. A Fire Upon the Deep by Werner Vinge. Continuing on page 96. Steele's den had originally been the master's. It was very different from the castle's meeting halls. Except for choirs, only a single pack would fit in any room. It was not exactly that the suite was small. There were 5 rooms, not counting the bath. But except for the library, none was more than 15 feet across. The ceilings were low, less than 5 feet. There was no space for visitor balconies. Servants were always on call in the 2 hallways that shared a wall with the quarters. The dining room, bedroom, and bath had smaller hatches, just big enough to give orders and to receive food and drink or use as a guard robe. The main entrance was guarded on the outside by 3 trooper packs. Of course, the master would never live in a den with only 1 exit. Steele had found 8 secret hatches, 3 in the sleeping quarters. These could only be opened from within. They led to the maze that Flenser had built within the castle's walls. No one knew the extent of that maze, not even the master. Steele had rearranged parts of it, in particular the passages leading from this den, in the years since Flenser's departure. The quarters were nearly impregnable. Even if the castle fell, the room's larder was stocked for 1/2 a year. Ventilation was provided by a network of channels almost as extensive as the master's secret passages. All in all, Steele felt only tolerably safe here. There was always the possibility that there were more than 8 secret entrances, perhaps one that could be opened from the other side. And, of course, choirs were out of the question, here or anywhere. The only extra pack sex that Steele indulged was with singletons, and that as part of his experiments. It was just too dangerous to mix oneself with others. After dinner, Steele drifted into the library. He relaxed around his reading desk. 2 of him sipped brandy while another smoked southern herbs. This was pleasure, but also calculation. Steele knew just what vices, applied to just which members, would raise his imagination to its keenest pitch. And more he was coming to see that imagination was at least as important as raw intelligence in the present game. The desk between him was covered with maps, reports from the South, internal security memos. But lying in all the silk paper, like an ivory slug in its nest, was the alien radio. They had recovered 2 from the ship. Steele picked the thing up, ran a nose along the smooth, curved sides. Only the finest stressed wood, and that in musical instruments or statuary, could match its grace. Yet the Mattis claimed this could be used to talk across dozens of miles, as fast as a ray of sunlight. If true, Steele wondered how many lost battles might have been won with these, how many new conquests might be safely undertaken. And if they could learn to make far-talkers, the movement subordinates scattered across the continent would be as near as the guards by Steele's den. No force in the world could stand against them. Steele picked up the latest report from woodcarvers. In many ways, they were having more success with their Mattis than was Steele with his. Apparently, theirs was almost an adult. More important, it had a miraculous library that could be interrogated almost like a living being. There had been 3 other data sets. Steele's white jackets had found what was left of them in the burnt-out wreckage around the ship. Yeffrey thought that the ship's processors were a little like a data set, only stupider, Omdi's best translation. But so far the processors had been useless. But with their data set, several on woodcarver's staff had already learned Mantis talk. Each day they discovered more about the alien civilization than Steele's people could in 10. He smiled. They didn't know that all the important stuff was being faithfully reported to Hidden Island. For now he would let them keep their toy and their Mantis. They had noticed several things that would have slipped by him. Still, he damned the luck. Steele paged through the report. Good. The alien at Woodcarver's was still uncooperative. He felt his smile spreading into laughter. It was a small thing, the creature's word for the packs. The report tried to spell out the word. It didn't matter. The translation was claws or tines. The mantis had a special horror for the tine attachments that soldiers wore on their forepaws. Steele looked pensively at the black enamel of his manicured claws. Interesting. Claws could be threatening things, but they were also part of being a person. Tines were their mechanical extension and potentially more frightening. It was the sort of name you might imagine for an elite killer force, but never for all the packs. After all, the race of packs included the weak, the poor, the kindly, the naive, as well as persons like Steele and Flenser. It said something very interesting about Mantis psychology that the creature picked tines as a characterizing feature of the packs. Steele eased back from his desk and gazed at the landscape painted around the library's walls. It was a view from the castle towers. Behind the paint, the walls were lined with patterns of mica and quartz and fiber. The echoes gave a vague sense of what you might hear looking out across the stone and emptiness. Combination audio-visuals were rare in the castle, and this one was especially well done. Steele could feel himself relaxing as he stared at it. He drifted for a moment, letting his imagination roam. Tines. I like it. If that was the alien's image, then it was the right name for his race. His pitiful advisors, and sometimes even the Flenser fragment, were still intimidated by the ship from the stars. No question, there was power in that ship beyond anything in the world. But after the first panic, Steele understood that the aliens were not supernaturally gifted. They had simply progressed, in the sense that Woodcarver made so much of, beyond the current state of his world's science. Certainly, the alien civilization was a deadly unknown right now. Indeed, it might be capable of burning this world to a cinder. Yet the more Steele saw, the more he realized the intrinsic inferiority of the aliens. What a bizarre abortion they were, a race of intelligent singletons. Every one of them must be raised from nothing like a wholly newborn pack. Memories could only be passed by voice and writing. Each creature grew and aged and even died as a whole. Despite himself, Steele shivered. He had come a long way from the first misconceptions, the first fears. For more than 30 days now, he'd been scheming to use the starship to rule the world. The Mantis said that ship was signaling others. That had reduced some of his servants to incontinence. So, sooner or later, more ships would arrive. Ruling the world was no longer a practical goal. It was time to aim higher, at goals even the Master had never imagined. Take away their technical advantages, and the Mantis folk were such finite, fragile beings. They should be easy to conquer. Even they seemed to realize this. Tines, the creature calls us. So it will be. Someday Tines would pace between the stars and rule there. But in the years till then, life would be very dangerous. Like a newborn pup, all their potential could be ended by one small blow. The movement's survival, the world's survival, would depend upon superior intelligence, imagination, discipline, treachery. Fortunately, those had always been Steele's great strengths. Steele dreamed in the candlelight and haze. Intelligence, imagination, discipline, treachery. Done right. Could the aliens be persuaded to eliminate all of Steele's enemies, and then bare their throats to him? It was daring almost beyond reason, but there might be a way. Jeffrey claimed he could operate the ship's signaler. By himself? Steele doubted it. The alien was thoroughly duped, but not especially competent. Amdaranafani was a different story. He was showing all the genius of his bloodlines. And the principles of loyalty and sacrifice his teachers drilled into him had taken hold, though he was a bit playful. His obedience didn't have the sharp edge that fear could bring. No matter. As a tool, he was useful beyond all others. Amdaranafani understood Yefri, and seemed to understand the alien artifacts even better than the Mantis did. The risk must be taken. He would let the two aboard the ship. They would send his message in place of the automatic distress signal, and what should that first message be? Word for word, it would be the most important, most dangerous thing any pack had ever said. 300 yards away, deep in the experiment wing, a boy and a pack of puppies came across an unexpected piece of good luck, an unlocked door, and a chance to play with Yefri's comset. The phone was more complex than some. It was intended for hospital and field work, for the remote control of devices, as well as for voice talk. By trial and error, the two gradually narrowed the options. Yefri Olshendott pointed to numbers that had appeared on the side of the device. "I think that means we're matched with some receiver." He glanced nervously at the doorway. Something told him they really shouldn't be here. "That's the same pattern as on the radio Mr. Steele took," said Andy. Not even one of his heads was watching the door. "I bet if we press it here, what we say will come out on his radio. Now he'll know we can help. So what should we do?" Three of Omdi raced around the room like dogs that couldn't keep their attention on a conversation. By now, Yefri knew this was the equivalent of a human looking away and humming as he thought. The angle of his gaze was another gesture, in this case a spreading and mischievous smile. "I think we should surprise him. He is always so serious." "Yeah." Mr. Steele was pretty solemn. But then all the adults were. They reminded him of the older scientists at the high lab. Andy grabbed the radio and gave him a just-watch-this look. He nosed on the talk switch and sang a long ululation into the mic. It sounded only vaguely like pack speech. One of Omdi translated next to Yefri's ear. The human boy felt giggles stealing up his throat. In his den, Lord Steele was lost in scheming. His imagination, loosed by herbs and brandy, floated free, playing with the possibilities. He was settled deep in velvet cushions, comfortable in the den's safety. The remaining candle shone faintly on the landscape mural, glinting from the polished furniture. The story he would tell the aliens, he almost had it now. The noise on his desk began as a small thing, submerged beneath his dreaming. It was mostly low-pitched, but there were overtones in the range of thought, like slices of another mind. It was a presence, growing. "Someone is in my den." The thought tore like Flenser's killing blade. Steele's members spasmed panic, disoriented by smoke and drink. There was a voice in the middle of the insanity. It was distorted, missing tones that any normal speech should have. It howled and quavered at him. "Lord Steele, greetings from the pack of packs, the Lord God Almighty." Part of Steele was already out the main hatch, staring wide-eyed at his guards in the hallway beyond. The trooper's presence brought a bit of calm and icy embarrassment. "This is nonsense." He tipped ahead to the alien device on his desk. The echoes were everywhere, but the sounds originated in the far talker. There was no pack speech now, just the high-pitched slices of sound, mindless warbling in the middle range of thought. Wait. Behind it all, faint and low, there were the coughing grunts he recognized as Mantis laughter. Steele rarely gave way to rage. It should be his tool, not his master. But listening to the laughter and remembering the words, Steele felt black bloodiness rising in first one member and then another. Almost without thought, he reached back and smashed the comm set. It fell instantly silent. He glared at the guards ranged at attention in the hallway. Their mind noise was quiet with stifled fear. Someone would die for this. Mr. Steele met with Omdi and Yefri the day after their success with the radio. They had convinced him. They were moving to the mainland. Yefri would have his chance to call for rescue. Steele was even more solemn than usual. He made a big thing about how important it was to get help to defend against another attack from the woodcarvers. But he didn't seem angry about Amdi's little prank. Jeffrey breathed a quiet sigh of relief. Back home, Daddy would have tanned his hide for something like that. I guess Amdi is right. Mr. Steele was serious because of all his responsibilities and the dangers they faced. But underneath, he was a very nice person. Crypto Zero. As received by Transceiver Relay 03 at Relay. Language Path, Fire Tongue to Cloud Mark to Trisqualine. SJK units, Fire Tongue and Cloud Mark are high beyond trade languages. Only core meaning is rendered by this translation. From Arbitration Arts Corporation at Firecloud Nebula. A high beyond military, organization. Known age, 100 years. Subject, reason for concern. Summary, three single system civilizations are apparently destroyed. Key phrases, scale interstellar disasters, scale interstellar warfare, Stromley realm perversion. Distribution, War Trackers Interest Group, Threats Interest Group, Homo Sapiens Interest Group. Date, 53.57 days since the fall of Stromley Realm. Text of message. Recently, an obscure civilization announced it had created a new power in the Transcend. It then dropped temporarily off the known net. Since that time, there have been about 1 million messages and threats about the incident. Plenty of speculations that a Class II perversion had been born, but no evidence of effects beyond the boundaries of the former Stromley realm. Arbitration Arts specializes in Trekkel-Lansing disputes. As such, we have few common business interests with natural races or threats group. That may have to change. 65 hours ago, we noticed the apparent extinction of 3 isolated civilizations in the high beyond near Stromley realm. 2 of these were I and the U religious probes, and the 3rd was a Pentragian factory. Previously, their main net link had been Stromley realm. As such, they have been off the net since Stromley dropped, except for occasional pinging from us. We diverted 3 missions to perform fly-throughs. Signal reconnaissance revealed wideband communication that was more like neural control than local net traffic. Several new large structures were noted. All our vessels were destroyed before detailed information could be returned. Given the background of these settlements, we conclude that this is not the normal aftermath of a transcending. These observations are consistent with a Class II attack from the Transcend, albeit a secretive one. The most obvious source would be the new power constructed by Stromley Realm. We urge special vigilance upon all high beyond civilizations in this part of the beyond. We larger ones have little to fear, but the threat is very clear. Crypto Zero, as received by Transceiver Relay 03 at Relay, Language Path, Fire Tongue to Cloud Mark to Trisqualine. SJK units, Fire Tongue and Cloud Mark are high beyond trade languages. Only core meaning is rendered by this translation. From Arbitration Arts Corporation at Firecloud Nebula, a high beyond military, organization. Known age, equivalent 100 years. Subject, new service available. Summary, Arbitration Arts to provide net relay service. Key phrases, special rates, sentient translator programs, ideal for civilizations in the high beyond. Distribution, Communication Costs Interest Group, Motley Hatch Administration Group. Date, 61.00 days since the fall of Stromley Realm. Text of message. Arbitration Arts is proud to announce a transceiver layer service especially designed for sites in the high beyond. Rates tabulated after the text of this message. State of the Zone programs will provide high quality translation and routing. It has been nearly 100 years since any high-beyond civilization in this part of the galaxy has been interested in providing such a communication service. We realize the job is dull and the armouflage not in keeping with the effort, but we all stand to benefit from protocols that are consistent with the zone we live in. Details follow under Syntax 8139. Cloudmark, Trisk Wayline Translator Program balks at handling Syntax 8139. Crypto 0. As received by Transceiver Relay 03 at Relay. Language path, CloudMark to Trisk Wayline, SJK units. CloudMark is a high beyond trade language. Despite colloquial rendering, only core meaning is guaranteed. From Transcendent Bafflements Trading Union at Cloud Center. Subject, matter of life and death. Summary, arbitration arts has fallen to Stroumly perversion via a net attack. Use middle beyond relays till emergency passes. Key phrases, net attack, scale interstellar warfare, Stroumly perversion. Distribution, War Trackers Interest Group, Threats Interest Group, Homo Sapiens Interest Group. Date, 61.12 days since the fall of Stroumly realm. Text of message, warning. The site identifying itself as Arbitration Arts is now controlled by the Stroumly perversion. The arts' recent advertisement of communications services is a deadly trick. In fact, we have good evidence that the perversion used sapient net packets to invade and disable the arts' defenses. Large portions of the arts now appear to be under direct control of the Stroumly power. Parts of the arts that were not infected in the initial invasion have been destroyed by the converted portions. Fly-throughs show several stealthifications. What can be done? If during the last 1,000 seconds you have received any high beyond protocol packets from Arbitration Arts, discard them at once. If they have been processed, then the processing site and all locally netted sites must be physically destroyed at once. We realize that this means the destruction of solar systems, but consider the alternative. You are under transcendent attack. If you survive the initial peril, the next 30 hours or so, then there are obvious procedures that can give relative safety. Do not accept high beyond protocol packets. At the very least, route all communications through middle beyond sites with translation down to and then up from local trade languages. For the longer term, it's obvious that an extraordinarily powerful Class II perversion has bloomed in our region of the galaxy. For the next 13 years or so, all advanced civilizations near us will be in great danger. If we can identify the background of the current perversion, we may discover its weaknesses and a feasible defense. Class II perversions all involve a deformed power that creates symbiotic structures in the high beyond. But there is an enormous variety of origins. Some are poorly formed jokes told by powers no longer on the scene. Others are weapons built by the newly transcendent and never properly disarmed. The immediate source of this danger is well documented. A species recently up from the middle beyond, Homo sapiens, founded Stroumly realm. We are inclined to believe the theory proposed in messages, ellipses, namely, that Stroumly researchers experimented with something in shortcuts and that the recipe was a self-booting evil from an earlier time. One possibility, some loser from long ago planted how-tos on the net or in some lost archive for the use of its own descendants. Thus, we are interested in any information related to Homo sapiens. The next day, Omdi went on the longest trip of his young life. Bundled in windbreakers, they traveled down wide cobbled streets to the straits below the castle. Mr. Steele led the way on a chariot cart drawn by 3 care hogs. He looked marvelous in his red-striped jackets. Guards dressed in white fur rolled along on either side, and the Dura Tyrefect brought up the rear. The aurora was as brilliant as Omdi Yefri had ever seen, brighter in some than the full moon that sat upon the northern horizon. Icicles grew down from buildings' eaves, sometimes all the way to the ground, glittering, green-silver pillars in the light. Then they were on the boats rowing across the streets. The water swept like chill black stone around the hulls. When they reached the other side, Starship Hill towered over them, higher than any castle could ever be. Every minute brought new visions, new worlds. It took half an hour to reach the top of that hill, even though their carts were pulled by care hogs and nobody walked. Omdi looked in all directions, awed by the landscape that spread, aurora-lit, below them. At first, Yefri seemed just as excited, but as they reached the hilltop, he stopped looking around and turned to hug his friend painfully hard. Mr. Steele had built a shelter around the starship. Inside, the air was still and a little warmer. Yefri stood at the base of the spidery stairs, looking up at the light that spilled from the ship's open doorway. Omdi felt him shivering. "Is he frightened of his own flyer?" asked Tyrethet. By now, Omdi knew most of Yefri's fears and understood most of the despair. "How would I feel if Mr. Steele were killed?"
"No, not scared. It's the memories of what happened here."
Steele said gently, "Tell him we could come again. He doesn't have to go inside today." Yefri shook his head at the suggestion, but couldn't answer right away.
"I've got to go on. I've got to be brave."
He started slowly up the stairs, stopping at each step to make sure that Omdi was still all with him. The puppies were split between concern for Yefri and the desire to rush madly into this wonderful mystery. Then they were through the hatch and into Two-Leg's strangeness. Bright bluish light, air as warm as in the castle, and dozens of mysterious shapes. They walked to the far side of the big room, and Mr. Steele stuck some heads in the entrance. His mind sounds echoed loudly around them. "I've quilted the walls, Omdi, but even so, there isn't room for more than one of us in here."
Yes.
There were echoes, and Steele's mind sounded strangely fierce. "It's up to you to protect your friend here, and let me know about everything you see." He moved back so that just one head still looked in upon them.
Yes, I will."
It was the first time anybody except Yefri had really needed him. Yefri wandered silently about the room full of his sleeping friends. He wasn't crying anymore, and he wasn't in the silent funk that often held him. It was as if he couldn't quite believe where he was. He passed his hands lightly across the caskets, looking at the faces within. "So many friends," thought Omdi, "waiting to be wakened. What will they be like?"
"The walls? I don't remember this," said Yefri.
He touched the heavy quilting that Steele had hung.
"It's to make the place sound better," said Omdi.
He pulled at the flaps, wondering what was behind. Green wall like stone and steel all at once, and covered with tiny bumps and fingers of gray.
"What's this?"
Yefri was looking over his shoulders.
"Ugh, mold. It's spread. I'm glad Mr. Steele has covered it up."
The human boy drifted away. Omdi stayed a second longer, poked several heads up close to the stuff. Mold and fungus were a constant problem in the castle. People were always cleaning it up, and perversely so, in Omdi's opinion. He thought fungus was neat, something that could grow on hardest rock, and this stuff was especially strange. Some of the clumps were almost half an inch high, but wispy, like solid smoke. The back-looking part of him saw that Yefri had drifted off toward the inner cabin. Reluctantly, Omdi followed. They stayed in the ship only an hour that first time. In the inner cabin, Yefri turned on magic windows that looked out in all directions. Omdi sat goggle-eyed. This was a trip to heaven. For Yefri, it was something else. He hunched down on a hammock and stared at the controls. The tension slowly left his face.
I like it here, said Omdi tentatively, softly.
Yefri rocked gently in a hammock.
Yes.
He sighed.
I was so afraid, but being here makes me feel closer to...
His hands reached out to caress the panel that hung close to the hammock.
My dad landed this thing. He was sitting right here.
He twisted around, looked at a glimmering panel of light above him.
And Mom got the ultrawave all set. They did it all. And now it's only you and me, Omdi. Even Johanna is gone. It's all up to us.
Vrinimi classification, organizational secret. Not for distribution beyond Ring 1 of the local net. Transceiver Relay 00 search log. Beginning, 19 hours, 40 minutes, 40 seconds, docks time, 17/01 of Orgear 52090. 128.13 days since the fall of Straumli Realm. Link layer syntax 14, message loop detected on assigned surveillance bearing. Signal strength and S/N compatible with previously detected beacon signal. Language path Somnorsh, SJK, relay units. From Jeffrey Olshendot at I don't know where this is. Subject, hello, my name's Jeffrey Olshendot. Our ship's hurt. And we need help. Please answer. Summary. Sorry if I get some of this wrong. This keyboard is stupid. Key phrases. I don't know. 2. Relay anybody. Text of message. Empty. Chapter 15. Two scrotoriders played in the surf.
Do you think his life is in danger? Asked the one with the slender green stalk.
Whose life? Said the other,
a large rider with a bluish basal shell.
Jeffrey Olshendot, the human child.
Blue Shell sighed to himself and consulted his scrota.
You come to the beach to forget the cares of the everyday, but Greenstalk would not let them go. He scanned for danger to Jeffrey.
Of course he's in danger, you twit. Look up the latest messages from him.
Oh, Greenstalk's tone was embarrassed.
Sorry for the partial remembering.
Remembering enough to worry and nothing more. She went silent. After a moment, he heard her pleasured humming. The surf crashed endlessly past them. Blue Shell opened to the water, tasting the life that swirled in the power of the waves. It was a beautiful beach. It was probably unique. And that was an extreme thing to say about anything in the beyond. When the foam swept back from their bodies, they could see indigo sky spread from one side of the docks to the other, and the glint of starships. When the surf came forward, the two riders were submerged in the turbid chill, surrounded by the coralesques and intertidal creatures that built their little homes here. And at high tide, the flexure of the seafloor held steady for an hour or so. Then the water cleared, and, if in daylight, they could see patches of glassy sea bottom, and through them, 1,000 kilometers below, the surface of ground side. Blue Shell tried to clear his mind of care. For every hour of peaceful contemplation, a few more natural memories would accumulate. No good. Just now, he could no more banish the worries than could Greenstalk. After a moment, he said,
Sometimes I wish I were a lesser rider.
To stand a lifetime in one place with just a minimum scrota.
Yes, said Greenstalk, but we decided to roam. That means giving up certain things. Sometimes we must remember things that happen only once or twice. Sometimes we have great adventures. I'm glad we took the rescue contract, Blue Shell.
So neither of them was really in the mood for the sea today. Blue Shell lowered the scrota's wheels and rolled a little closer to Greenstalk. He looked deep into his scrota's mechanical memory, scanning the general databases. There was a lot there about catastrophes. Whoever created the original scrota databases had considered wars and blights and perversion very important. They were exciting things, and they could kill you. But Blue Shell could also see that in relative terms, such disasters were a small part of the civilized experience. Only about once in a millennium was there a massive perversion. It was their bad luck to be caught near such a thing. In the last 10 weeks, 12 civilizations in the high beyond had dropped from the net,
absorbed into the symbiotic amalgam that now was called the Stroumley Blight. High trade was crippled. Since their ship was refinanced, he and Greenstalk had flown several jobs, but all to the middle beyond. The two of them always had been very cautious, but now, as Greenstalk said, greatness might be thrust upon them. Vrenimi Org wanted to commission a secret flight to the bottom of the beyond. Since he and Greenstalk were already in on the secret, they were the natural choice for the job. Right now, the out-of-band two was in the Vrenimi yards getting bottom lugger enhancements and a huge stock of antenna drones. In one stroke, the OOB's value was increased 10,000-fold. There had been no need even to bargain, and that was the scariest thing of all. Every addition was a clear essential for the trip. They would be descending right to the edge of the slowness. Under the best of circumstances, this would be a tedious exercise, but the latest surveys reported movement in the zone boundaries. With bad luck, they might actually end up on the wrong side, where light had the ultimate speed. If that should happen, the new ram scoop would be their only hope. All that was within Blue Shell's range of acceptable business. Before he met Greenstalk, he had shipped on bottom luggers, even been stranded once or twice. But
I like adventure as much as you, said Blue Shell, a grumpy edge creeping into his voice. Traveling to the bottom, rescuing sophants from the claws of wild things, given enough money, it's all perhaps reasonable. But what if that Straumer ship is really as important as Ravna thinks? After all this time, it seems absurd, but she's convinced Vrenimi Org of the possibility. If there's something down there that could harm the Straumley Blight...
If the Blight ever suspected the same, it could have a fleet of 10,000 warships descending on their goal. Down at the bottom, they might be little better than conventional vessels, but he and Greenstalk would be no less dead for that. Except for a faint, daydreamy hum, Greenstalk was silent. Had she lost track of the conversation? Then her voice came to him through the water, a reassuring caress.
I know, Blue Shell, it could be the end of us, but I still want to venture it. If it's safe, we make enormous profit. If our going could harm the Blight, well, then it's terribly important. Our help might save dozens of civilizations, a million beaches of riders, just in passing.
Humph. You're following Stalk and not Scrota.
Probably.
They had watched the progress of the Blight since its beginning. The feelings of horror and sympathy had been reinforced every day till they percolated into their natural minds. So Greenstalk, and Blue Shell too, he couldn't deny it, felt stronger about the Blight than about the danger in their new contract.
Probably. My fears of making the rescue are still analytical.
Still confined to her Scrota.
Yet, I think if we could stand here a year, if we could wait till we truly felt all the issues, I think we would still choose to go.
Blue Shell rolled irritably back and forth. The grit swirled up and threw his fronds. She was right. She was right. But he couldn't say it aloud. The mission still terrified him.
And think, mate, if it is this important, then perhaps we can get help. You know the Org is negotiating with the emissary device. With any luck, we'll end up with an escort designed by a transcendental power.
The image almost made Blue Shell laugh. Two little Scrota riders journeying to the bottom of the beyond, surrounded by help from the Transcend.
I will hope for it.
The Scrota riders were not the only ones with that wish. Further up the beach, Ravna Bergschendott prowled her office. What gruesome irony that even the greatest disasters can create opportunities for decent people. Her transfer to marketing had been made permanent with the fall of Arbitration Arts. As the Blight spread and high beyond markets collapsed, the Org became ever more interested in providing information services about the Straumley perversion. Her special expertise in things human suddenly became extraordinarily valuable. Never mind that Straumley realm itself was only a small part of what was now the Blight. What little the blight said of itself was often in Somnorsh. Gronder and company continued to be vitally interested in her analysis. Well, she had done some good. They had picked up the refugee ship's I Am Here, and then, 90 days later, a message from a human survivor, Jeffrey Olshendott. Barely 40 messages had they exchanged, but enough to learn about the Tynes and Mr. Steele and the evil woodcarvers. Enough to know that a small human life would be ended if she could not help. Ironic, but natural. Most times, that single life weighed more on her than all the horror of the perversion, even the fall of Straumli Rome. Thank the powers that Gronder had endorsed the rescue mission. It was a chance to learn something important about the Straumli perversion. And the Tynish packs seemed to interest him, too. Group minds were a fleeting thing in the beyond. Gronder had kept the whole affair secret and persuaded his bosses to support the mission. But all his help might not be enough. If the refugee ship was as important as Ravna thought, there could be enormous perils awaiting any rescuers. Ravna looked across the surf. When the waves backed down the sand, she could see the Skrota rider's fronds peeping out of the spray. How she envied them! If tensions annoyed them, they could simply turn them off. The Skrota riders were one of the most common sophants in the beyond. There were many varieties, but analysis agreed with legend. Very long ago, they had been one species. Somewhere in the off-net past, they had been sessel dwellers of seashores. Left to themselves, they had developed a form of intelligence almost devoid of short-term memory. They sat in the surf, thinking thoughts that left no imprints on their minds. Only repetition of a stimulus over a period of time could do that. But the intelligence and memory that they had was of survival value. It made it possible for them to select the best possible place to cast their pupil seeds, locations that would mean safety and food for the next generation. Then some unknown race had chanced upon the dreamers and decided to help them out. Someone had put them on mobile platforms, the Skrotas. With wheels, they could move along the seashores, could reach and manipulate with their fronds and tendrils. With the Skrota's mechanical short-term memory, they could learn fast enough that their new mobility would not kill them. Ravna glanced away from the Skrota riders. Someone was floating in over the trees. The emissary device. Maybe she should call Greenstalk and Blueshell out of the water. No. Let them bliss out a little longer. If she couldn't get the special equipment, things would be tough enough for them later. Besides, I can do without witnesses. She folded her arms across her chest and glared into the sky. The Vrinimi Org had tried to talk to the Old One about this, but nowadays the power would only work through its emissary device, and he had insisted on a face-to-face meeting. The emissary touched down a few meters away and bowed. His lopsided grin spoiled the effect. Vom Nuen at your service. Ravna gave a little bow in return and led him to the shade of her inner office. If he thought that face-to-face would unnerve her, he was right.
Thanks for the meeting, sir.
The Vrinimi organization has an important request of your principal, owner, master, operator. Vom Nuen plunked himself down, stretching indolently. He'd stayed out of her way since that night at the Wandering Company. Gronder said Old One had kept him at Relay, though, rummaging through the archives for information about humanity and its origins. It made sense now that Old One had been persuaded to restrict its net usage. The emissary could do local processing, that is, use human intelligence to search and summarize and then upload only the stuff that Old One really needed. Ravna watched him out of the corner of her eye as she pretended to study her data set. Fom had his old lazy smile. She wondered if she would ever have the courage to ask him how much of their affair had been a human thing. Had Fom Nguyen felt anything for her? Hell, did he even have a good time? From a transcendent point of view, he might be a simple data concentrator and Waldo,
but from her viewpoint, he was still too human.
Yes.
Well, the Argus continued to monitor the Stroumley refugee ship, even though your principal has lost interest. Fon's eyebrows raised in polite interest.
Oh?
10 days ago, the simple "I am here" signal was interrupted by a new message, apparently from a surviving crew member.
Congratulations. You managed to keep it a secret, even from me.
Ravna didn't rise to the bait.
We're doing our best to keep it secret from everyone, sir, for reasons that you must know.
She put the messages to date on a display between them. A handful of calls and responses scattered across 10 days. Translated into Trisk Wayline for Fom, the original spelling and grammar errors were gone, yet the tone remained. Ravna was responsible for the org side of the conversation. It was like talking to someone in a dark room, someone you have never seen. Much was easy to imagine, a strident, piping voice behind the capitalized words and exclamation marks. She had no video of the child, but through the Humankind Archive at Chandra K, marketing had dug up pictures of the boy's parents. They looked like typical Straumers, but with the brown eyes of the Linden clans. Little Yefri would be slim and dark. Fom Nguyen's gaze flicked down through the text, then seemed to hang on the last few lines. Org 17. How old are you, Yefri?
Target 18.
I am 8. I mean, I am 8 years old. I am old enough, but I need help.
Org 18.
We will help. We are coming as fast as we can, Yefri.
Target 19.
Sorry I couldn't talk yesterday. The bad people were on the hill again yesterday. It wasn't safe to go to the ship.
Org 19.
Are the bad ones that close by?
Target 20.
Yes, yes. I could see them from the island. I'm with Amdi on shipboard now, but walking up here, there were dead soldiers all around. Woodcarver raids here often. Mother is dead. Father is dead. Johanna is dead. Mr. Steele will protect me as much as he can. He says that I must be brave.
For a moment, his smile was gone.
Poor kid, he said softly. Then he shrugged and jabbed his hand at one of the messages.
Well, I'm glad Vrinimi is sending a rescue mission. That is generous of you.
Not really, sir. Look at items 6 through 14. The boy is complaining about the ship's automation.
Yeah, he makes it sound like something out of a Dawn Age. Keyboards and video, no voice recognition. A completely unfriendly interface. Looks like the crash scragged almost everything, eh?
He was being deliberately obtuse, but Ravna resolved to be infinitely patient.
Perhaps not, considering the vessel's origin.
Fom just smiled, so Ravna continued to spell things out.
The processors are likely high beyond or transcendent, snuffed down to near brainlessness by the current environment.
Fom knew and sighed.
Oh, consistent with the Scrotorider's theory, right? You're still hoping this crate is carrying some tremendous secret that will blow the blight away.
Yes. Look, at one time the old one was very curious about all this. Why the total disinterest now? Is there some reason why the ship can't be the key to fighting the perversion?
That was Gronder's explanation for the old one's recent lack of interest. All her life, Ravna Bergschendott had heard tales of the powers, and always from a great remove. Here she was awfully close to questioning one directly. It was a very strange feeling. After a moment, Fom said,
No, it's unlikely, but you could be right.
Ravna let out a breath she hadn't realized she'd been holding.
Good. Then what we're asking is reasonable. Suppose the downed ship contains something the perversion needs or something it fears. Then it's likely the perversion knows of its existence and may even be monitoring ultra-drive traffic in that part of the bottom. A rescue expedition could lead the perversion right to it. In that case, the mission will be suicide for its crew and could increase the Blight's overall power.
So?
Ravna slapped her data set, resolutions of patience dissolving.
So,
Vrinimi.org is asking old one's help to build an expedition the Blight can't knock over.
Von Neuwen just shook his head. Ravna, Ravna, you're talking about an expedition to the bottom of the beyond. There's no way a power can hold your hand down there. Even an emissary device would be mostly on its own there.
Don't act like more of a jerk than you are, Von Neuwen. Down there, the perversion will be at just as much a disadvantage. What we're asking for is equipment of transcendent manufacture, designed for those depths, and provided in substantial quantities.
Jerk!
Von Neuwen drew himself up, but there was still the ghost of a smile on his face.
Is that how you normally address a power?
Before this year, I would have died rather than address a power in any manner. She leaned back, giving him her own version of an indolent smile. You have a pipeline to God, mister, but let me tell you a little secret. I can tell whether it's open or closed.
Polite curiosity.
Oh, how is that?
Von Neuwen, left on his own, is a bright, egotistical guy and about as subtle as a kick in the head. She thought back to their time together. I don't really start worrying until the arrogance and smart remarks go away.
Your logic is a little weak. If the old one were running me direct, he could just as easily play a jerk as... He cocked his head. As the man of your dreams.
Ravna gritted her teeth. Maybe so, but I've got a little help from my boss. He's cleared me to monitor transceiver usage.
She looked at her data set.
Right now, your old one is getting less than 10 kilobits per second from all of relay, which means, my friend, that you are not being teleoperated. Any crass behavior I see today is the true Von Neuwen.
The redhead chuckled, faint embarrassment evident. You got me. I'm on detached duty. Have been ever since the Org persuaded Old One to back off. But I want you to know that all those 10 KBs are dedicated to this charming conversation.
He paused as if listening, then waved his hand.
Old One says hi.
Ravna laughed, despite herself. There was something absurd about the gesture and the notion that a power would indulge such trivial humor. Okay. I'm glad he can, sit in. Look, Fom, we're not asking for much by transcendent standards, and it could save whole civilizations. Give us a few thousand ships. Robot one-shots would be fine.
Old One could make that many, but they wouldn't be much better than what's built down here. Tricking, he paused, looking surprised by his own choice of words, tricking the zones is subtle work.
Fine. Quality or quantity. We'll settle for whichever the Old One thinks.
No.
Fom, we're talking about a few days' work for the Old One. It's already paid more to study the Blight. Their single wild evening might have cost as much. But she didn't say that.
Yes, and Vrinimi has spent most of it.
Paying off the customers you stepped on. Fom, can't you at least tell us why?
The lazy smile faded from his face. She took a quick glance at her data set. No, Von Neuwen was not possessed. She remembered the look on his face when he read the mail from Jeffrey Olschendott. There was a decent human being lurking behind all the arrogance. I'll give it a try. Keep in mind, even though I've been part of Old One, I'm remembering and explaining with human limitations. You're right. The perversion is chewing up the top of the beyond. Maybe 50 civilizations will die before this power gets tired of screwing around. And for a couple of thousand years after that, there'll be echoes of the disaster. Poisoned star systems, artificial races with bloody-minded ideas. But, I hate to say it this way, so what? Old One has been thinking about this problem off and on for more than 100 days. That's a long time for a power, especially Old One. He's existed for more than 10 years now. His minds are drifting fast toward changes that will put him beyond all communication. Why should he give a damn about this? It was a standard topic in school, but Ravna couldn't help herself. This time it was for real.
But history is full of incidents where powers helped beyonder races, sometimes even individuals.
She had already looked up the beyonder race that created Old One. They were gas bag creatures. Their net mail was mostly Jabberwocky, even after Relay's best interpretation. Apparently, they had no special leverage with Old One. The direct appeal was about all she had.
Look, turn the thing around. Even ordinary humans don't need special explanation to help animals that are hurting.
Fom's smile was beginning to come back. You're so big on analogies. Remember that no analogy is perfect, and the more complex the automation, the more complex the possible motivations. But, okay, how about this for an analogy? Old One is a basically decent guy with a nice home and a good part of town. One day he notices he has a new neighbor, a scruffy fellow whose homestead is a whiff with toxic sludge. If you were Old One, you'd be concerned, right? You might probe around beneath your properties. You'd also chat with the new fellow and check on where he came from, try to figure out what's going on. The Vreeni Meorg saw part of that investigation. So, you discover the new neighbor is unwholesome. Basically, his lifestyle involves poisoning swampland and eating the sludge produced. That's an annoyance. It smells and it hurts a lot of harmless animals. But after investigating, it's clear the damage will not affect your own property, and you get the neighbor to take measures to reduce the stink. In any case, eating toxic sludge is a self-defeating lifestyle. He paused. As analogies go, I think this one's pretty good. After some initial mystery, Old One has determined that this perversion is one of the common patterns, so petty and banal that even creatures like you and I can see its evil. In one form or another, it's been drifting up from beyond our archives for 100 million years.
Damn it, I'd get my neighbors together and run the pervert out of town.
That's been talked about, but it would be expensive. And real people might get hurt.
Fom Nguyen came smoothly to his feet and smiled dismissingly at her.
Well, that's about all we had to say to you.
He walked out from under the trees. Ravna hopped up to pursue.
My personal advice, don't take this so hard, Ravna. I've seen it all, you know. From the bottom of the slowness to the inside of a transcendent power, each zone has its own special unpleasantness. The whole basis of the perversion, thermodynamic, economic, however you want to picture it, is the high quality of thought and communication at the top of the beyond. The perversion hasn't touched a single civilization in the middle beyond. Down here, the comm lags and expense are too great, and even the best equipment is mindless. To run things here, you'd need standing navies, secret police, clumsy transceivers. It would be almost as awkward as any other beyonder empire and of no profit to a power. He turned and saw her dark expression. Hey, I'm saying your pretty ass is safe. He reached down to pat her rear. Ravna brushed the hand away and stepped back. She'd been working on some clever argument that might set the guy to thinking. There were cases where emissary devices had changed their principal's decision. Now the half-formed ideas were blown away, and all she could think to say was,
So how safe is your own tail, hmm? You say Old One is about ready to pack it in, go wherever overage powers wander off to. Is he going to take you along, or maybe just put you away, a pet that's now inconvenient?
It was a silly shot, and Fom Nguyen just laughed. More analogies? No, most likely he'll just leave me behind. You know, like a robot probe flying free after its last use. Another analogy, but one to his liking. In fact, if it happens soon enough, I might even be willing to take on this rescue expedition. It looks like Yefri Olshendot is in a medieval civilization. I'll wager there's no one in the org who understands such a place better than I. And down at the bottom, your crew could scarcely ask for a better mate than an old Chang Ho type.
He spoke breezily, as though courage and experience were givens for him, even if other people were cowardly scuts.
Oh, yeah?
Ravna's arms went akimbo, and she cocked her head to one side. It was just a bit too much when his whole existence was a fraud.
You're the little prince who grew up with intrigue and assassination and then flew away to the stars with the Cheng Ho. Do you ever really think about that past, Fom Nguyen, or is that something Oldwin tactfully blocks you from doing?
After our charming evening at the Wandering Company, I did think about it. You know what? There's only a few things you can know for sure. You really were a slow-zone spacer, probably two or three spacers since none of the corpses were complete. Somehow you and your buddies got yourselves killed down at the nether end of the slowness. What else? Well, your ship had no recoverable memory. The only hard copy we found seemed to be written in some Earth Asian language. That's all that Oldwin had to go on when he put together the fraud.
Fom's smile seemed a little frozen. Ravna went on before he could speak.
But don't blame Oldwin. He was a little rushed, right? He had to convince Rinimi and me that you were real. He rummaged around in the archives, slapped together a mishmash reality for you. Maybe it took him an afternoon. Are you grateful for the effort? A snip from here and a snip from there. There really was a Cheng Ho, you know, on Earth, 1,000 years before spaceflight. And there must have been Asia-descended star colonies, though that's an obvious extrapolation on his part. Oldwin really has a nice sense of humor. He made your whole life a fantastic romance, right down to the last tragic expedition. That should have tipped me off, by the way. It's a combination of several pre-New Yoran legends.
She caught her breath and rushed on.
I feel sorry for you, Fom Nguyen. As long as you don't think about yourself too hard, you can be the most confident fellow in space. But all the skill, all the achievement, do you ever look at it up close? I'll bet not. Being a great warrior or an expert pilot, those involve a million sub-skills, all the way down to kinesthetic things below the level of conscious thought. The old one's fraud needed just the top-level recollections and a brash personality. Look under the surface, Fom. I think you'll find a whole lot of nothing.
A dream of competence, too closely confronted.
The redhead had crossed his arms and was tapping his sleeve with a finger. When she finally ran out of words, his smile grew broad and patronizing.
Ah, silly Ravna. Even now you don't understand how far superior the powers are. Oldwin is not some middle beyond tyranny, brainwashing its victims with superficial memories. Even a transcendent fraud has more depth than the image of reality in a human mind. And how can you know this really is a fraud? So you looked through the relay archives and didn't find my Cheng Ho.
My Cheng Ho. He paused. Remembering? Trying to remember? For an instant, Ravna saw a gleam of panic on his face. Then it was gone, and there was just the lazy smile.
Can any of us imagine the archives of the Transcend, all the things Oldwin must know about humanity? Vrinimi Org should be grateful to Oldwin for explaining my origins. They could never have learned that by themselves. Look. I am truly sorry I can't help. Even if it's otherwise a fool's errand, I'd like to see those kids rescued. But don't worry about the blight. It's near maximum expansion now. Even if you could destroy it, you wouldn't make things better for the poor whites who've been absorbed. He laughed a little too loudly. Well, I have to go. Oldwin has some other errands for me this afternoon. He wasn't happy about this being face-to-face, but I insisted. The perks of detached duty, you know. You and I had some good times, and I thought it would be nice to chat. I didn't mean to make you mad.
Fom cut in his agrav and floated off the sand. He waved a laconic salute. Staring up, Ravna lifted her hand to wave back.
His figure dwindled, acquiring a faint nimbus as he left the dock's breathable atmosphere and his spacesuit cut in. Ravna watched a few moments more till the figure became one more commuter in the indigo sky. Damn, damn, damn. Behind her, there was the sound of wheels crunching across sand. Blue Shell and Greenstalk had rolled out of the water. Wetness glistened on the sides of their scrotas, transforming their cosmetic stripes into jagged rainbows. Ravna walked down to meet them. How do I tell them there's no help coming? With someone like Fom Nguyen fronting for it, Old One had seemed so different from what she imagined in her classes back at Chandra K. She'd almost thought she could make a difference just by talking. What a joke. She had caught a glimpse just now behind the front of a being who could play with souls the way a programmer plays with a clever graphic, a being so far beyond her that only its indifference could protect her. Be happy, little Ravna Moth. You were only dazzled by the flame. Chapter 16. The next few weeks went surprisingly well. Despite the Fom Nguyen debacle, Blue Shell and Greenstalk were still willing to fly the rescue. Rini Miorg even kicked in some extra resources. Every day, Ravna took a tele-excursion to the repair yards. The out-of-band, too, might not be getting any transcendent enhancements, but when the refitting was complete, the ship would be something extraordinary. Now it floated in a golden haze of structures, billions of tiny robots regrowing sections of the hull into the characteristic form of a bottom lugger. Sometimes the ship seemed to Ravna like a fragile moth, and sometimes an abyssal fish. The rebuilt ship could survive across a range of environments. It had the spines of an ultra-drive craft, but the hull was streamlined and wasp-waste. The classic form of a ram-scoop ship. Bottom luggers must troll dangerously near the slow zone. The zone's surface was hard to detect from a distance, even harder to map, and there were short-term position changes. It was not impossible for a lugger to be trapped a light year or two within the slowness. It was then you'd thank goodness for the ram scoop and the cold sleep facilities. Of course, by the time you returned to civilization, you might be completely out of date, but at least you could get back. Ravna floated her viewpoint through the drive spines that spread out from the hull. They were broader than those on most ships that came to relay. They weren't optimal for the middle or high beyond, but with appropriate, that is, low beyond, computers, the ship would fly as fast as anything when it reached the bottom. Gronder let her spend half time on the project, and after a few days, Ravna realized this was not just a favor. She was the best person for this job. She knew humans, and she knew archive management. Geoffrey Oceandot needed reassurance every day. And the things Geoffrey was telling her were immediately important. Even if everything went according to plan, even if the perversion stayed completely out of it, this rescue was going to be tricky. The kid and his ship seemed to be in the middle of a bloody war. Extracting them would mean making instantly correct decisions and acting on them. They would need an effective onboard database and strategy program. But not much could be expected to work at the bottom, and memory capacity would be limited. It was up to Ravna to decide what library materials to move to the ship to balance the one ease of local availability against the greater resources that would be accessible over the ultra-wave from relay. Gronder was available on the local net and often in real time. He wanted this to work. "Don't worry, Ravna. We'll dedicate part of R00 to this mission. If their antenna swarm works properly, the riders should have a 30 kb's link to relay. You'll be their prime contact here, and you'll have access to our best strategists. If nothing interferes, you should have no trouble managing this rescue." Even 4 weeks ago, Ravna wouldn't have dared to ask for more. Now,
"Sir, I have a better idea. Send me with the scrota riders."
all of Grander's mouthparts clapped together at once. She'd seen that much surprise in people like Egrivan, but never in the staid Grander. He was silent for a moment. "No, we need you here. You are our best sanity check when it comes to questions about humankind." The news groups interested in the Straumli perversion carried more than 100,000 messages a day, about a tenth of that human-related. Thousands of messages were old ideas rehashed, or patent absurdities, or probable lies. Marketing's automation was fairly good at filtering out the redundancy and some of the absurdity, but when it came to questions on human nature, Ravna was without equal. About half her time was spent guiding that analysis and handling queries about humankind at the archives. All that would be next to impossible if she left with the Schroederiders. Over the next few days, Ravna kept pushing her boss on the question. Whoever flew the rescue would need instant rapport with humans. Human children, in fact. Very likely, Jeffrey Olshendott had never even met a Schroederrider. The point was a good one, and it was gradually driving her to desperation, but by itself it would not have changed old Grander's mind. It took some outside events to do that. As the weeks passed, the Blight's expansion slowed, just as conventional wisdom and Old One via Fom Nguyen claimed. There seemed to be natural limits to how far the perversion could extend its interests. The abject panic slowly disappeared from the high beyond communication traffic. Rumors and refugees from the absorbed volumes dribbled toward zero. The people in the blighted spaces were gone, but now it was more like death in a graveyard than death from contagious rot. Blight-related news groups continued to babble about the catastrophe, but the level of non-productive rehashing was steadily increasing. There simply was very little new going on. Over the next 10 years, physical death would spread through the blighted region. Colonization would begin again, cautiously probing through the ruins and informational traps and residue races. But all of that was a ways off, and for the moment, Relay's blight, Windfall, was a shrinking affair. And marketing was even more interested in the Straumli refugee ship. None of the strategy programs, much less Grander, believed the ship's secret could hurt the blight, but there was a good chance it might bring commercial advantage when the perversion finally got tired of its transcendent game. And the Tyne's pack mines had caught their interest. It was appropriate that a maximum effort be made, that Ravna give up her doc's job and go into the field. So, for a wonder, her childhood fantasy of rescue and questing adventure would actually come true. And even more surprising, I'm only half terrified by the prospect. Target 56. "I'm sorry I didn't answer for a while. I don't feel good a lot. Mr. Steele says I should talk to you. He says I need more friends to make me feel better. Andy says so too, and he's my best friend of all. Like packs of dogs, but smart and fun. I wish I could send pictures. Mr. Steele will try to get answers for all your questions. He is doing everything he can to help, but the bad packs will be back. Omdi and I tried the stuff you said with the ship. I am sorry it still doesn't work. I hate this dumb keyboard." Org 57. "Hi, Jeffrey. Omdi and Mr. Steele are right. I always like to talk, and it will make you feel better. There are inventions that might help Mr. Steele. We've thought of some improvements for his bows and flamethrowers. I'm also sending down some fortress design information. Please tell Mr. Steele that we can't tell him how to fly the ship. It would be dangerous even for an expert pilot to try." Target 57. "Yeah, even Daddy had a hard time landing it. IKOCXLJIKERSW89IOU43E5. I think Mr. Steele just doesn't understand, and he's getting sort of disparate. Isn't there other stuff, though, like they had in olden days? You know, bombs and airplanes that we could make?" Org 58.
There are other inventions, but it would take time for Mr. Steele to make them. Our starship is leaving Relay soon, Jeffrey. We'll be there long before other inventions would help. Target 58. You're coming? You're finally coming? When do you leave? When will you get here? Ordinarily, Rodna composed her messages to Jeffrey on a keyboard. It gave her some feeling for the kid's situation. He seemed to be holding up, though there were still days when he didn't write. It was strange to think of mental depression having any connection with an 8-year-old. Other times, he seemed to have a tantrum at the keyboard, and across 21,000 light-years, she saw evidence of small fists slamming into keys. Ravna grinned at the display. Today, she finally had something more than nebulous promises for him. She had a definite departure time. Jeffrey was going to like message 59. She typed, "We're scheduled to leave in 7 more days, Jeffrey. Travel time will be about 30 days. Should she qualify that? Latest postings on the zone boundary news groups said the bottom was unusually active. The Tynes world was so close to the slow zone. If the storm worsened, travel time would suffer. There was about a 1% chance the voyage would take more than 60 days. She leaned back from the keyboard. Did she really want to say that? Damn. Better be frank. These dates could affect the locals who were helping Jeffrey. She explained the ifs and buts, then went on to describe the ship and the wonderful things they would bring. The boy usually didn't write at great length, except when he was relaying information from Steele, but he really seemed to like long letters from her. The out-of-band, too, was undergoing final consistency checks. Its ultra-drive was rebuilt and tested. The scrotorwriters had taken it out a couple of thousand light-years to check the antenna swarm. The swarm worked great, too. She and Jeffrey would be able to talk through most of the voyage. As of yesterday, the ship was stocked with consumables. That sounded like something out of medieval adventure, but you had to take some supplies when you were headed so far down that reality graphics couldn't be trusted. Sometime tomorrow, Gronder's people would be loading the ship's hold with gadgets that might be real handy for a rescue. Should she mention those? Some of them might sound a bit intimidating to Jeffrey's local friends. That evening, she and the scrotorwriters had a beach party. That's what they called it, though it was much more like the human version than an authentic rider one. Blueshell and Greenstalk had rolled well back from the water to where the sand lay dry and warm. Ravna laid out refreshments on Blueshell's cargo scarf. They sat on the sand and admired the sunset. It was mostly a celebration that Ravna had gotten permission to go with the OOB, that the ship was almost ready to depart.
"But are you really happy to be going, my lady?" asked Blueshell. "We two will make very good money, but you..."
Ravna laughed.
"I'll get a travel bonus."
She had argued and argued for permission to go. There wasn't much room left to haggle about the pay.
"And yes, this is what I really want."
"I am glad," said Greenstalk. "I am laughing," said Blueshell. "My mate is especially pleased that our passenger will not be surly. We almost lost our love for bipeds after shipping with the certificates. But there is nothing to be frightened of now. Have you read Threat's group in the last 15 hours? The blight has stopped growing, and its edges have become sharply defined. The perversion is settling into middle age. I'm ready to leave right now."
Blueshell was full of speculations about the Tynish packs and possible schemes for extracting Jeffrey and any other survivors. Greenstalk interjected a thought here and there. She was less shy than before, but still seemed softer, more diffident than her mate. And her confidence was a bit more realistic. She was glad they weren't leaving for another week. There were still the final consistency checks to run on the OOB, and Gronder had gotten Org financing for a small fleet of decoy ships. 50 were complete so far. 100 would be ready by the end of the week. The docks drifted into night. With its shallow atmosphere, twilight was short, but the colors were spectacular. the beach and the trees glistened in the horizontal rays, the scent of even flowers mixed with the tang of sea salt. On the far side of the sea, all was stark bright and dark, silhouettes that might have been Vrinimi fancies or functional dock equipage. Ravna had never learned which. The sun slid behind the sea. Orange and red spread along the aft horizon, topped by a wider band of green, probably ionized oxygen. The riders didn't turn their scrotas for a better view. For all she knew, they had been looking that way all along, but they stopped talking. As the sun set, the breakers shattered it into a thousand images, glints of green and yellow through the foam. She guessed the two would have preferred to be out there just now. She had seen them often enough around sunset, deliberately sitting where the surf was hardest. When the water drew back, their stalks and fronds were like supplicants' arms upstretched. At times like these, she could almost understand the lesser scrota riders. They spent their whole lives memorizing such repeated moments. She smiled in the greenish twilight. There would always be time enough later to worry and plan. They must have sat like that for 20 minutes. Along the curving line of the beach, she saw tiny fires in the gathering dark. Office parties. Somewhere very nearby, there was the crunch, crunch of feet on sand. She turned and saw that it was Fahm Nguyen. "Over here," she called. Fahm ambled toward them. He'd been very scarce since their last confrontation. Ravna guessed that some of her jibes had struck deep. "This once, I hope Oldwin made him forget." Fahm Nguyen had the potential to be a real person. It hadn't been right to hurt him because his principle was beyond reach. "Have a seat. Galaxy rise in a half hour." The scrota riders rustled so deep into the sunset that they were only now noticing the visitor. Fahm Nguyen walked a pace or two beyond Ravna and stood arms akimbo staring across the sea. He glanced back at her, and the green twilight gave his face an eerie fierceness. He flashed his old, lopsided smile. "I think I owe you an apology." "Oldwin's gonna let you join the human race after all?" But Ravna was touched. She dropped her eyes from his. "I guess I owe you one, too. If Oldwin won't help, he won't help. I shouldn't have lost my temper." Fahm Nguyen laughed softly. "Yours was certainly the lesser error. I'm still trying to figure out where I went wrong, and I don't think I have time now to learn." He looked back at the sea. After a moment, Ravna stood and stepped toward him. Up close, his stare looked glassy. "What's wrong?" "Damn you, Oldwin. If you're going to abandon him, don't do it in pieces. You're the great expert on transcendent powers, eh?" More sarcasm. "Well..." "Do the big boys have wars?" Ravna shrugged.
"You can find rumors of everything. We think there's conflict, but something too subtle to call war."
"You're pretty much right. There is struggle, but it has more angles than anything down here. The benefits of cooperation are normally so great that... That's part of the reason I didn't take the perversion seriously. Besides, the creature is pitiful, a wimpy cur that fouls its own den. Even if it wanted to kill other powers, something like that never could. Not in a billion years."
Blue Shell rolled up beside them.
"Who is this, my lady?"
It was the sort of riderish conversation stopper that she was only just getting used to. If Blue Shell would just get in sync with his scrota memory, he'd know. Then the question truly hit her. "Who is this?" She glanced at her data set. It was showing transceiver status, had been ever since Fahm Nguyen arrived. And, by the powers, three transceivers had been grabbed by a single customer. She took a quick step backwards.
"You?"
"Me. Face to face once more, Ravna."
The leer was a parody of Fahm's self-assured smile.
"Sorry I can't be charming tonight." He slapped his chest awkwardly. "I'm using this thing's underlying instincts. I'm too busy trying to stay alive."
There was drool coming down his chin. Fahm's eyes would focus on her and then drift.
What are you doing to Fahm?
The emissary device stepped toward her, stumbled. Making room, came Fahm Nguyen's voice. Ravna spoke Gronder's phone code. There was no response. The emissary device shook its head. Vrini Miorg is very busy right now, trying to convince me to get off their equipment, trying to screw up their courage and force me off. They don't believe what I'm telling them. He laughed, a quick choking sound. Doesn't matter. I can see now the attack here was just deadly diversion. How about that, little Ravna? See, the blight is not a Class II perversion. In the time I have left, I can only guess what it is. Something very old, very big. Whatever it is, I'm being eaten alive. Blueshell and Greenstalk had rolled close to Ravna. Their fronds made faint scritching noises. Some thousands of light-years away, well into the transcend, a power was fighting for its life. And all they saw of it was one man turned into a slobbering lunatic. So that's my apology, little Ravna. Helping you probably wouldn't have saved me. His voice strangled on itself, and he took a gasping breath. But helping you now will be a measure of... Vengeance is a motive you would understand. I've called your ship down. If you move fast and don't use a grav, you may survive the next hour. Blueshell's voice was timid and blustery at the same time. Survive? Only a conventional attack could work down here, and there is no sign of one. A maniac surrounded by the soft, quiet night. Ravna's dataset showed nothing strange except for the diversion of bandwidth to Old One. End of Side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.